You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Welcome to another special edition of the podcast from FQXI's 5th International Meeting in Banff, Alberta. I'm Zia Morali. On Friday, cosmologist Sean Carroll spoke about his latest research. Many physicists, when trying to think about what the world looks like on small scales, start with a classical framework, a picture of the world in which objects have definite properties, and then try to modify it to make it quantum, quantizing their theory. Carroll and his colleagues are doing things the other way around. They argue that nature is fundamentally quantum, and so they are starting from the space in which quantum effects work, called a Hilbert space. Starting from that point, they then try to convert back to the classical world. Their idea is that space, and perhaps even gravity, emerge from quantum entanglement. Intriguingly, they are also proposing that the evolution of systems can be described using things called quantum circuits.
I'm Sean Carroll from Caltech. I'm going to give the worst kind of talk, where rather than saying one thing clearly and distinctly, I'm going to say many things very fast. The hope is to maybe provoke you into thinking about things a little bit, or at the very least, not give you enough time to think through their conclusions so you can't really get worried about them. There is at least an underlying theme, which I call mad dog Everettianism. So Everett in the sense of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. And this is an especially extreme form in that I'm not even going to allow myself to rely on some preferred set of operators, or in particular local operators. I'm going to define what I mean by a quantum mechanical theory by just a Hilbert space, H. There's a state evolving in it, and it obeys Schrodinger's equation. So that's all you have. You have the dimensionality of H, you have the Hamiltonian, and you have some specific state. There might be an advanced version of this where you don't even have a Hamiltonian, where instead you have replaced your pure state psi by some operator, density operator, and try to get emergent time, leaving that for future work, if you believe that there's such a thing as the future and time is fundamental. And the crucial point here that I will add to the usual discussions of Everett is an assumption that the parts of Hilbert space I'll be looking at are finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. That's going to be extremely useful and relevant to everything I say. The attitude here is that I'm really living in Hilbert space. I'm not quantizing anything. Nature doesn't quantize things. Nature doesn't start with electromagnetism or a simple harmonic oscillator and then quantize it. Nature just is quantum mechanical. So I'm going to start with states in Hilbert space and ask what they might represent. That's a really, really hard question to answer, as it turns out. Now, why finite dimensional should be added here in the first place? I rearranged my talk. The first thing I'm going to say is, why can I get away without telling you what the observables are? So because I'm looking at finite dimensional pieces of Hilbert space, the observables are just every self-adjoint operator. Every Hermitian operator I have in my little sub-factor of Hilbert space with finite dimension is an observable. I couldn't get away with that if the Hilbert space were infinite dimensional, because different algebras, different C-star algebras of observables would be inequivalent, and I would have to add that new information. But for finite dimensionality, I'm okay. You might want to say, well, okay, this is all Hermitian operators, but what are the local operators? What are the preferred operators that commute and I build my theory on the basis of? I don't believe in such things. I think we should derive when such a notion should be useful given the state in the Hamiltonian and different circumstances. For example, we have examples of dualities, either popular ones like ADS-CFT, where there's a theory on the boundary and a different theory in the bulk, or very straightforward ones like Bose-Fermi dualities, where you have different possible ideas of what your local operators are in precisely the same quantum theory. So I want this particular situation you find yourself in, state and Hamiltonian, to determine what you want to think of as a local operator. And I can do that because we're finite dimensional. So why can I get away with finite dimensional? This is an old argument that I think everyone knows, and I don't think has been quite absorbed by the community as much as it should. The argument, which may or may not be true, but is at least sensible, says that if you want to put entropy in a region of space, the maximum entropy that you can put in a region of space is a black hole. It has an entropy that is a finite number. It is the area, given by Stephen Hawking's formula, the area over 4G. And if you have a region that is in a maximum entropy configuration, then you know something about the Hilbert space. The dimensionality of the Hilbert space is e to the entropy. That's the crucial step here. So that means that whatever goes on in this region of space is described by a Hilbert space of dimensionality e to the a over 4g. And that's a big number, but it's finite. And if that's going to be true for black holes, we posit that it's true for every region of space in the regime where whatever theory you're talking about can be approximated as some classical space-time in some regime of approximation. So if that's true, if Hilbert space is finite dimensional, that has enormous implications. Quantum field theory in particular assumes that Hilbert space is infinite dimensional from the start, so quantum field theory is going to have to be an approximation at best. And deriving Lorentz invariants is going to be a big project. In fact, there are many things that you're going to need to derive. I'm not going to derive them all. This project is nowhere near complete. Some of these I do have very good ideas for. Some of them we don't. This is full employment for everyone in the room if you want to tackle all of these ideas. But we have some very, very interesting proposals, let's put it that way. So to keep the organizers happy, let me say a little bit about the topic of the session we're in, and I'll refer back to Charlie Bennett's talk. What is it that happens if you have a wave function and you haven't been told your preferred set of observables or anything like that? Well, there's a very naive way of thinking about it, that you're given some state and the probability of fluctuating into some other state is just the wave function squared, the Born rule for that happening. The analysis that I gave that Charlie Bennett mentioned with Kim Boddy and Jason Pollock suggested that that, of course, is really the probability that an observer measures that thing to be the case. It is not the probability that thing happens all by itself. There's a difference between a measurement-induced result and a true dynamical Boltzmann fluctuation like you would get in a classical thermal gas or something like that. So we claim that in truly globally stationary states, nothing fluctuates into existence because the state is exactly the same at every moment in time. In particular, in the true Bunch-Davies-de-Sitter vacuum in de Sitter space, it's a stationary state. You can write down coordinates in which nothing ever happens in time. And therefore, you do not get dynamical fluctuations into Boltzmann brains in the de Sitter vacuum, in the true actual de Sitter vacuum. Now, Charlie says he doesn't believe you, and then he gives an example which is not the true de Sitter vacuum. And I agree with his example, but I don't think it happens in the real cosmological world. I think that we will approach the real de Sitter vacuum. There will be nothing happening. We don't need to worry about Boltzmann brains in that situation. Sadly, this attitude is not universally shared. Charlie gave his objection to it. Seth Lloyd, who's also here somewhere, gave another very interesting objection to it. Where is he? There he is, right there. Okay. So Seth, I'm just teasing him because he has this paper in preparation that he wrote in 2014. So I'm going to keep getting him preparing it. He hasn't written it yet. He points out, well, let's imagine we do have a stationary quantum state. We can ask, what happens in a stationary quantum state? One way you might try to answer that question is using decoherent histories. You could ask yourself, even though the state is not changing over time, could I come up with some coarse graining, some set of observables that I impose projection operators at different times that define a set of histories, and could I find histories that decohere from each other that are dynamical? Even though the state is absolutely stationary, the individual histories could be time dependent. And if they decohere from each other, we might make the argument that these states really represent things that are happening. So in a simple harmonic oscillator ground state, for example, the perfect example of a stationary state, he defines some phase states, which are basically telling you how your oscillator is moving around the circle in phase space, more or less. And he points out that if you chug forward in time by the right amount, one such phase state just evolves into the next such phase state. And as time goes on, you can find histories in which the oscillator, this static ground state of the oscillator, can be thought of as a set of individually dynamical trajectories in which the oscillator is rocking back and forth. And these trajectories perfectly well decohere. By the standards of decoherent histories, you can think of them as things that happen. Our response to that is that what that means to us is that decoherent histories is necessary but not sufficient to tell you whether something is happening. This is by far not a unique way of dividing up this particular state into different sets of histories that do decohere. There are an infinite number of ways of dividing up at this particular stationary state into sets of histories that decohere. And then if you took this attitude, you would have to say that many, many things, essentially every single thing, happens in every single quantum state. I think that's a little bit too permissive, even by Canadian standards. So what we want to argue, but I don't think this is completely developed, is that if you really want to say that something is happening, at least in the Boltzmann brain sense of sort of a conscious kind of observer experiencing things in the wave function, you need more than decoherent histories. You need that, but something extra. You need, in fact, an arrow of time, some increase of entropy that can give that purported observer some notion of having memories of what happened. And I actually agree with almost everything else that Charlie Bennett said about this. I think this is the crucial point when it comes to asking what happens in quantum wave functions. We normally assume an enormous amount about the measurement process. When we do ever-ready in quantum mechanics, we draw equations like this, where you start a system in a ready state, which has some system in a superposition, unentangled with an apparatus in the ready state and in the environment. And that statement that it's initially unentangled is a statement of low entropy. If you calculate the reduced density matrix for the apparatus in the system, it is low entropy compared to what it could be. It's unentangled. That is very far from generic. That is a special past hypothesis, as we say in the foundations of statistical mechanics. Then what happens is entanglement happens. First the apparatus becomes entangled with the system, then the environment, and eventually you decohere, so the environment states become orthogonal, and you have two separate worlds. I'm suggesting that you need all of this stuff going on in order to say that something happens in the wave function in the ordinary sense. It is not sufficient simply to have histories that decohere. The histories have to have these features of increasing entropy toward the future, records redundantly stored in fragments of the environment, as Jess Riedel and Charlie and Zurek and others have said. Scott Aronson has also made the argument that if you want to talk about consciousness, memory, information processing, you need this kind of arrow of time. So this kind of setup drives home one of the elements of that list of things you need to derive, which I think is probably, and Jess Riedel has done a wonderful job in emphasizing this, the big underdeveloped question in ever-ready in quantum mechanics, the so-called set selection problem. This was put forward more or less by Adrian Kent and Faye Dauker, and Jess has been pushing it on his blog, which I encourage you to read. This is, in very simple terms, the question of who decides what is the system and what is the environment. Or more generally, you take your one big Hilbert space, you write it as a tensor product of many little Hilbert spaces. Who decides what particular way there is of dividing it up that way? If you really fine-grain it enough, that becomes equivalent to asking what are your set of local observables that you should be looking at. We always, we ever-readians, when we analyze the world, we assume it right from the start. We write the Hilbert space as a system times an environment. I should back up a little bit and of course say that the decoherent histories people have been much better about this. They are much more general about the sets of coarse grainings that we can do, but I think that there's a version of this problem that is very down to earth in the laboratory kind of thing that makes perfect sense in the system environment tensor product kind of split. When you do this, you could easily undo it. You could do it in a million different ways. You could do a unitary transformation that changes what you mean by system and environment, and that would change what you mean by local observables. If you don't have a preferred notion of what it is you quantize to get your theory, you're not given this split from the start. How do you get it? I don't know, but we're working on it. The tentative suggestion we have is that this procedure we have of decoherence has two things going on. This is the reduced density matrix for a system that is being observed in ever-ready in quantum mechanics. Starts in a ready state, it becomes entangled with the apparatus, so there's some off-diagonal elements. Decoherence happens, which squelches those off-diagonal elements. And we're suggesting once again that you need all of this stuff. What you try to do is find the system environment split that maximizes how quickly decoherence happens, but minimizes the rate at which branching of the wave function happens. That is to say, I can stay here as some robust, consistent, persistent, more or less classical apparatus. I do not have all of the different degrees of freedom in my body instantly become entangled in different ways with the environment. We would like to sort of have some minimum maximization procedure that picks out a preferred system environment split among all the possibilities. We're not really close to that. We have ideas, but we're trying to develop that. I think it's an interesting direction to go in. Once you have that, I think there are a wonderful set of results that do fall into place. One of them is, I think you can derive the Born rule in a way that not only gets you that the probability is the wave function squared, but that answers a question that Don Page asked a while ago about what happens when you have not only quantum uncertainty because you're branching the wave function, but classical uncertainty because in each branch of the wave functions there are multiple identical observers, as you have in a multiverse. So Chip Siebens and I were able to use something called self-locating uncertainty. When you, the observer, here Hugh Everett, you have an apparatus, you have a cat that you're going to observe, there's a moment when the apparatus has become entangled with the system, but you, the observer, have not. There are then two copies of you, the observer, at that moment. You don't know which one you are. Under some very simple assumptions, you can use that uncertainty and give it a unique measure, and that measure turns out to be the Born rule. And that measure generalizes very straightforwardly to the combination of classical uncertainty and quantum uncertainty and gives you a measure, if you like, on the multiverse. We can also talk about the emergence of space. Remember, we're not assuming space from the start, we're assuming Hilbert space. But what we know from our experience of quantum field theory is that in regions of space, in the vacuum, regions of space that are nearby are more highly entangled than regions that are further away. So we can try to go backwards. We can say, let's define close by as regions that are highly entangled and far away as regions that are little entangled. We can use the mutual information between different factors of Hilbert space to define a metric. And we can actually plug in and find that in simple cases where we know what the quantum state is, we can recover the classical geometry. The exciting thing about this is we might be able to get gravity for free. If you imagine that distances are defined by entanglement, and you modify the state a little bit, you modify the entanglement, and the distance automatically gets modified. What happens is that the spatial curvature of your emergent spatial geometry is proportional to something called the modular Hamiltonian, which can be thought of as the logarithm of the density matrix. And in the infrared limit, where you look like a conformal field theory, we can relate the modular Hamiltonian to the honest-to-goodness Hamiltonian of a quantum field theory. And what that means is you get a spatial relation. We're only using space here, not space-time. But if you're lucky enough and put this in the framework of a theory where this holds in every reference frame in some Lorentz invariant context, the covariant version of this equation, which is just Einstein's equation. So in other words, rather than taking some classical geometric theory and quantizing it, we're looking in the wave function, asking how space emerges, and of course the geometry of that space is going to respond to changes in the state, and of course once that happens it's going to be something more or less like Einstein's equation. The difficult part here is, of course, getting it to be Lorentz invariant, continuous in the limit, look like field theory in appropriate limit, et cetera, none of which we have yet done. Let me close with two quick bonus results that this kind of thinking gets you. One is you can derive the cosmic no-hair theorem, which says that if you have a cosmological constant and let the universe evolve for long enough, you will eventually end up in De Sitter space. From this point of view, where you think about everything in terms of Hilbert space and density matrices and entropy, the equivalent statement is if you have a maximum amount of entropy, if you have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, then that process of cosmic no-hair getting you to De Sitter space is just thermal equilibration. You go towards your maximum entropy state. So Raphael Busso and Netta Engelhardt have defined a very nice way of getting the generalized second law in a cosmological context using something called a Q-screen. And Aidan Chatwin-Davis and I were able to take a kind of metric, a cosmological metric, but anisotropic, so you have different scale factors for the different directions, a Bianchi model. And we show, without using Einstein's equation, just using the fact that entropy increases and hits a maximum, that the foundation, that the form of these scale factors approaches that of De Sitter space. So we sort of make a little bit more tangible the feeling that many people have that De Sitter space is in fact the highest entropy configuration of a cosmological spacetime. And finally, and most provocatively, you can think about the unitary evolution of finite dimensional quantum systems in terms of what are called quantum circuits. You can actually have a set of qubits or some other primitive factors of your Hilbert space and have unitary gates that act like a circuit in computer science theory, evolving your cosmological state forward in time. So a bunch of us thought about, well, what would that mean literally in cosmology? And what we realized is, if you have an upper limit on the dimensionality of Hilbert space, if there's a top number that you can have for the number of entangled qubits in your state, then you have states that continue to entangle more and more qubits. That can only go on for so long. So from this point of view, where space is an emergent phenomenon depending on the entanglement of fundamental degrees of freedom, what we mean by the expansion of space, the expansion of the universe, is just that we start with ancilla degrees of freedom in our Hilbert space that are initially unentangled, and a set of gates entangle them with the rest of the space-time degrees of freedom. The expansion of the universe, there's always been this weird puzzle in cosmology, right, where the universe expands, somehow there are degrees of freedom, there are wavelengths that were below the Planck scale, and they get stretched by the expansion of the universe, and they magically appear in your low-energy quantum field theory now. How did that happen? This point of view provides you with an answer to that. It's not that new degrees of freedom are being created. The Hilbert space was always the same size as it always was. It's that many of the degrees of freedom were unentangled. Your initial low entropy state only had a very small number of entangled degrees of freedom. And this quantum circuit brings more and more of them into entanglement, thereby expanding the universe. But there's only so far it can go. The entropy of our De Sitter patch today is of order 10 to the 122. So therefore, there can be only so many steps, only so many layers in the quantum circuit that describes your cosmological evolution. You turn this into a bound on the total number of E folds in the history of the universe, and it's 140. What that means is that there's an upper bound on the number of inflationary E folds, if you believe in the existence of inflation, which is about 75, which is a little bit more, but not too much more, than the number of E folds you need inflation to have to do the job of inflation. Now, what this means is that if you have at least one qubit in your universe that is related and tangled with the qubits we have today, there's a total amount of expansion the universe could totally have undergone. Anything before that, which is classically allowed, is quantum mechanically completely irrelevant for the current state of our universe. Thank you.
That was Sean Carroll speaking at FQXI's 5th International Meeting in Banff, Alberta. Visit www.fqxi.org/community for more audio, video and blog posts from the conference. Talks are already up from Paul Davis on the origin of life and Matt Leifer on why the standard interpretation of quantum theory is wrong. We're also live tweeting from the meeting at FQXI. I've been Zia Morali.